It's back. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is Life in Equinox podcast time again. I'm sure you're stoked up like I am. Thrills, screaming, crying, dreams, really. That's what it's all about. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But welcome to Life in Equinox podcast number 10. Pretty excited. I'm glad to be back because I took about a month off when I was doing my 23 Days of Kurosawa. Hope you all enjoyed that. And then I took a couple weeks off because, well, I was mentally pooped and just didn't have the time to deal with a podcast and all the fun little things that go along with it. Like, oh my god, where did all these buttons go? And why does my MP3 no longer load? And oh, all that thrilling and exciting stuff. But you're not here to hear me complain, except unless it's related to movies. So, we've got an interesting slate today. I don't have a lot of movies because I just haven't had the time to see them. And the ones I have had the time to see have been reviewed on my website, so I'll talk a little bit about those. But most of the time is going to be spent on two movies, one Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, Christopher Columbus's latest film, and Save the Tiger, a 1973 film starring Jack Lemmon. But first, let's go a little bit down the movies I have seen and have reviewed. This week, I actually reviewed a movie I'm regretted I went to see, which was Boondock Saints 2. And I've defended, within reason, I think, that I really enjoy the original Boondock Saints, because I think it is so stupid and over the top that it's just kind of entertaining. But Boondock Saints 2, if you enjoyed Boondock Saints at all, watching Boondock Saints 2 is kind of like watching, I don't know, a bad spinoff of a show. It just feels like someone said, see, we're going to take everything that we did right on this one, and we're going to do it again, and we're going to do it all wrong, and we're going to see how that works. But it was just, it was horrible. It was a disaster. I can't even really explain it. It was very kind, I think, when I gave it a 4. I probably should have given it in the 3s, but I was entertained, and so I felt it deserved some points for that. But I probably shouldn't have gotten that many points, really. And another movie I got to see, though, over this past weekend was How to Train Your Dragon. And I really enjoyed this one. I gave it a 7.75, which I think is a high score for me because my scale's all screwy. It was really enjoyable, and I got a lot of good laughs. The only problem I had with that movie was the theater. And you expect when you go to a kid's movie on a day off from school, there's going to be a lot of kids there. Theater was jam-packed. Completely expected. But I'm a bit of a weird moviegoer. There's a reason I go to the movies with my mom a lot. Because my mom's a good person to go to the movies with. She knows how to watch movies. Kids, the downside, they don't really know how to watch movies. And so I'm sitting here watching How to Train Your Dragon, and the kid behind me is kicking the chair. We've got kids in there talking, whining, coughing. And I'm sitting there like, I can't hear the dialogue. I want to hear what they're saying. I want this kid to stop kicking me in the back. I want that kid up there to shut up. I want that kid over there to be quiet, too. Come on! But it's a bit like going to a zoo, you know? Especially for the first 5 minutes, because a lot of people are coming in late. That's another thing that annoys me. You have... The movie started at 11:50. We had about 15 to 20 minutes of commercials. Get there on time! You're already 20 minutes after the scheduled showtime. Show up on time. I mean, I guess I understood because there was a long line outside for the movie. Well, there was, like, I think 3 or 4 movies that started at that same time, but there was a long line, so I can understand people being late. But if you're going to be late, you should come into the theater quiet. You know, you shouldn't walk back and forth in front of everybody. Just, you know, put your head down and shuffle up to a seat, you know? You can find one. It's usually, you know, 1 or 2 people coming in late, but overall, I will say, I really enjoyed How to Train Your Dragon. It was highly entertaining. I had a lot of fun aspects to it, which I think is important because I've seen a lot of movies recently that just, they don't feel like they're trying to be entertaining. I don't know what it is. Maybe just the movies I've selected. They're just trying to be either, you know, artsy, or they're trying to be this or that, and they can still be good, but I like to sit down and watch a movie that just really engrosses me and is entertaining. And that's what How to Train Your Dragon is. It's not reinventing the wheel. And by wheel here, I'm referring to the family film. It takes all the elements that make family films good, puts them in the right order, puts the right people involved, and just executes it. And that's what you have to do. You know, it's got great visuals, great characters, and a lot of fun moments, and a lot of really thrilling moments. And the ending is very exciting, very over-the-top and extreme, and lots of explosions and fun, family-friendly goofiness. I like that. I like having that sort of to-go-to escape. And when movies don't do that, I always feel kind of like, come on, please, just give me a little bit of that. And it gave me what I wanted, and I was very, very pleased with that. And the other movie I reviewed a little bit over a week ago now was The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Now, I saw this movie a long, long time ago, and I'm just now getting around to review it because I stopped reviewing anything except for I hopped in for Shutter Island because I didn't want to be reviewing it way too long after it was unimportant. And Dr. Parnassus was a movie I actually was really captivated by, but it's very flawed, you know? It has a lot of little things that are wrong, and they kind of add up. But I enjoyed the story, I enjoyed the morality, and I liked Terry Gilliam's spin on it all. Even if Terry Gilliam does have a little bit of, I don't know, obsession with visuals over substance at times. And this is especially prevalent towards the ending when you get to the finale and the big chase sequence through the Imaginarium and all this different stuff. And I felt like sometimes the shots he designed were not, you know, they were like to show visuals more than they were to show the characters who are going through a lot of this. But that doesn't detract from the fact that there's a lot of fun characters in it, a lot of really good, I think, creative visuals. Not so much beautiful visuals, but creative. And I think it's a nice spin on that good versus evil constant dynamic. You know, that we have the Dr. Parnassus, who kind of relates. He's almost a godlike figure in that he's not a good guy or a perfect guy, but he's the morally, he believes in the high morality of man. Then you have Mr. Nick, who's the embodiment of the devil, and he believes all people can be flawed, and they're constantly at war with one another, and they make bets for the so over the souls of people, you know? And I think that's really, you know, it was really well done. I liked it. I was intrigued by it. I think he could have added some more, I wouldn't say, not action as in, you know, big explosions, but action plot points to move the plot along. I feel like it lulled a little bit in the middle with not too much going on. But I was captivated enough by it, and I think that was something I enjoyed about it. I was happy to be immersed in the world for a while, and I didn't feel like I was being forced or felt like the characters were doing things that, you know, just to move the plot along. And I liked that. And now we're gonna get that sort of sums up what I was going to talk about for the movies I've recently reviewed. I mean, you can go to my blog, univarn.blogspot.com. You can read all these reviews. But now we're going to move into a couple of movies I've seen recently that I haven't reviewed on my blog yet. And I'm going to talk about them for a while. And the first movie up is Save the Tiger. If you don't know this movie, it's a 1973 drama that stars Jack Lemmon, directed by John G. Avildsen, I should start practicing these names, and written by Steve Shagan. And it's basically about this man, Harry Stoner, who is an executive for a clothing company that's pretty much got one foot in the grave and another foot on, you know, mud. And, you know, they're down and out, you know. Their new line has to sell a lot of money, but even if it does sell, their company's already so broke that he just can't make the money. So, pretty much you spend one day for about an hour and 30 minutes, an hour and 40 minutes of movie. You're spending one day with Harry Stoner. And it's his bad day. You know, he's the kind of guy, you know, he has post-traumatic stress disorder from his time in World War II. He feels detached from society. And you kind of watch him. He go through all these different events. You know, he's trying to organize with a guy to have his building burnt down so he can collect the insurance money, or not burnt down, but you know, have a fire started in his building so he can collect insurance money. He's constantly, it's I don't, it's one of those, like, you know, if you watch the pile on days, you know, and so it's a very dreary film, not a lot of chipper and uppity mood. And Harry Stoner is played by Jack Lemmon, and I will say this movie is a premium example of a good movie that looks worse because of a great performance, if you know what I mean. It's a little bit like Crazy Heart in that the flaws of the movie become more evident because the performance is so great. It kind of weighs down the other elements of the movie, and the reason I think that is because the movie's so centered on Harry Stoner. Jack Lemmon has to be good. I mean, if he's not good, you don't have much of a plot. You don't have anything going on. I mean, there's not like a simple singular plot. It's just what he does that day. You know, he gets up in the morning and he talks with his wife who's about to go out of town, and he complains about how he doesn't understand this and understand that, and then he goes to work and, you know, he talks to his good friend with a great performance by Jack Gilford, Phil Green, who's his friend and business partner, and they go through their sort of daily actions. You know, he's negotiating with his employees who are fighting, and he's trying to get people to do this and trying to do that, and then he's got to go meet this guy, and he's got to go to this guy, and then he has a client who wants a prostitute, so he helps organize that because he needs the money. And you know, it's you see a lot of different things happen, but it's not like a singular plot point. It's really just, this is your worst day, what happens to you? And Jack Lemmon delivers an amazing performance, especially with these kind of movies, because in these movies, there's almost always like a towards the end, I don't know what to say it, but like the emotional breakthrough scene, you know, where the character comes out and he says one thing that summarizes everything about this character so far, you know, one of those really cheesy scenes. But Jack Lemmon and the writer Steve Chagan really actually managed to do this throughout the entire finale. The entire last 30 minutes is just riddled with really deep character lines. You know, there's a scene when Jack Lemmon's character is introducing his new clothing, the new clothing line for the company. And you just look at the expression on his face as he's going through this, and he's struggling because he's having a day in which he's really reminded of the war, and a lot of things are reminding him of that. And it's just like, you watch his facial expressions, it's amazing. I mean, you can look at something and be like, that's great acting. And the way he approaches it is just amazing. And I've always had a really huge soft spot for Jack Lemmon. He's one of my all-time favorite actors. He makes this movie good. You know, without him, I'm not sure this movie would make it, because he does all of the little things throughout the entire movie that make it so impactful on you. That it really, I don't know, it makes it an impactful movie and a good movie and an important movie to watch because of that. But there are a few real downsides to the movie. One, it's not a very exciting movie. It's a very dreary movie, very dark and down. Our main character is very down. About the only thing he really enjoys doing is sitting around and just throwing out names of baseball players, which I'm sure people who love baseball will appreciate that, because he's just sitting there looking in the window, smoking a cigarette, naming off old school baseball players. That's sort of his release from the world. But it's a very dreary film, not a very, you know, happy-go-lucky movie. And then there's a very kind of, I don't know, the ending, it's not underwhelming, I wouldn't say, so much as under-executed. Because John G. Avildsen is a good director, I think. He's had a very up-and-down career. I mean, you know, he went from this, and he went on to do Rocky, but he also did Rocky V. He did The Karate Kid, but he also did The Karate Kid Part 3. You know, so he's always had a bit of an up-and-down career. And here, I wonder if the small budget had something to do with the fact that it always feels a little undercut. The editing feels a little shaky. I don't know. I would say it's if you really like Jack Lemmon, if you enjoy watching him act, this is a must-see movie. If you're not a big fan of Jack Lemmon, if you don't like these kind of middle-aged, dreary man movies, I would say avoid it, because it is very heavy into that genre. But overall, I think it was a solid movie and a great performance. And, you know, that's sometimes, and that's what gets you an Oscar, you know? And that's what got Jack Lemmon his best acting Oscar. And you compound that with his best supporting acting Oscar for Mr. Roberts, another movie I really enjoy. And I think it actually was the first time anyone had won both Best Supporting Actor and Best Actor in their career. But overall, quality. That's all I gotta say. And after 10 minutes of talking, I'm glad I just figured out all I have to say. Now we're gonna flash forward to 2010. Was that a reference to a TV show that's probably not gonna have a second season? Yes, it was. But I got to see Percy Jackson and the Olympians about a month ago. And I didn't really want to see it, but I got kind of talked into it. I was like, alright, might as well check it out. Because I do enjoy these adventure films. I like movies like Stardust and the Harry Potter films and the Lord of the Rings movies. I love fantasy adventure films. It's not a hard sell for me. All you really have to do is care about the material. Percy Jackson, the movie, doesn't care. The entire time I watched Percy Jackson, I had one thought in the back of my mind. I bet the book is good. That was my thought the entire time. Because the movie was just atrociously mediocre. And I mean that with the utmost positive and negative aspects of it. There's some good action in it. Some creative plays on Greek mythology. But the main acting cast is horrible. I'm sorry, I don't dislike Lugan, Lerman, or Brandon T. Jackson, or Alexandra Daddario, but you're very mediocre here. Very unemotional, very one note. I think that's actually the best way I could describe the entire movie of Percy Jackson. One note. It has one note, one string on its guitar, and it's gonna beat that string until the end of time, because that's the only thing it knows how to do. It can't do anything else. And it's horrible in some moments because something happens about 15 minutes into the movie to the main character, Percy Jackson, that for most of us would likely send us into an emotional catatonic state. It's a very emotional thing, and he does the normal hero thing, rawr, I'm gonna beat everything up, rawr. But then he thinks it's a dream, and he wakes up the next morning and he finds out that what he thought may have possibly could have not happened actually did happen. And his reaction is this: oh no, that really happened? Paging Keanu Reeves Acting School 101. This is the lesson on Brendan Fraser. Please show emotion. And that's the entire movie. A couple smirks, maybe a wisecrack, but no emotion. Nobody cares. Nobody seems to care. They all just seem happy to be in front of the camera. Hello, I'm in front of the camera now. Please give me screen time. Oh no, I'm out of the camera. And that's that one flaw that haunts the entire movie. None of them seem to care about each other, even in the movie's most intense emotional moments. They're all just like, oh no, please don't go there. Oh no, what's happening to you? Oh, are you okay? It's that just dry delivery the entire time. Even in happy moments, you know? Wow, this is mine? I am so shocked and awed. Smile. It's very, very, very bland acting. And Christopher Columbus's directing's not much better than it was for the first two Harry Potter movies. But the thing he did well about the first two Harry Potter movies is he trusted the characters. Even if he was very fascinated by the visuals and the allure of the world, he trusted the characters. Here, Christopher Columbus doesn't trust the characters. That may have to do with the acting, but he doesn't trust them. And so, they're always side characters to the action throughout the entire movie. And that shouldn't happen. The action should enforce the characters. The characters shouldn't enforce the action, if you understand what I mean. And so, by the time the movie hits its finale, I was just very, 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 very indifferent. I didn't care. And that's just how the movie ended. I mean, by the time it was over, I was like, alright, guess I won't be watching the sequel. That was my opinion of it. It felt like it didn't know what it wanted to be. And that's a shame, because there's a lot there that I saw that I was like, that just looks like it would be fun if executed well. That looks like it could be well done if executed well. And it never was. And that's a problem. Because if you don't execute it, if you don't care, the movie's in a struggle. And you know what? Percy Jackson, anyone, just don't bother watching it. I hate to say it. I love supporting fantasy films, but just don't watch it. They don't care. Why should you care? And they're the ones who made it, you know? So I would just highly recommend not watching that movie. And I'm going to get onto something more chipper and exciting. Well, not really. Everything's exciting when I'm doing it. Darn it. Yes, I'm arguing with myself. Way to go, me. But I was actually thinking this week about list making. Because there's a lot of list going around. A lot of people are doing... I think just really a common trait among blogging is we like to do lists. You know, Fandango Groover's movie blog has this the deserted island, you know, your top 8 deserted island movies, and he's getting a bunch of people involved in that. You know, if you were on a desert island, what movies would you take? That sort of thing. But we like to make our lists as bloggers. We really enjoy list making. And so I've started thinking a little bit about the art of list making, because 2 years ago, well, about a year and a half ago, I sat down and I made my top 100 films list. I think I started with 200 movies, and I narrowed it down to 150, and eventually 100. And I think I just started listing them off the top of my head, and just any movie I ever enjoyed at all, and I started working them around. And even to this day, I'm not exactly thrilled with all the positions. Some movies, I'm like, well, why did I put that there? I kind of wish I had put a note next to it. You know, why is this there? Because it's like, I don't even remember why I put that on there. And so you can probably imagine an upcoming time that list is going to get changed. But one thing I really was interested by is Rotten Tomatoes does their top 5 films list with different actors and directors and such. They'll come on and Rotten Tomatoes will interview them and they'll, you know, list their top 5 films. And I think it was Andy Garcia or Edward Norton recently. One of them did it recently. They both did it recently, but one of them did it recently. And I saw a comment on there. It talks about... He was complaining that none of the movies listed were within the last 10 or 15 years. And I started looking at my top 100 films list. And I said, well, when is my first most recent film? And my top... In my top 10, the most recent movie is Shawshank Redemption at 94. But I also have Pulp Fiction at 94 at 11, so... But the first movie I have from this decade is Lord of the Rings Return of the King. That's from 2003. After that, I have Spirited Away. But once you get past those two, until you get to The Pianist down at 31, I don't have a lot of movies from this decade in my top premium film. And the most recent movie I have in my top 5 is 1966. And so, I was thinking, how do we make the list we make? Because I think for me, when I put this list together, I had a deadline in 2008 that the movie had to be out at least a year. That's why the most recent movie on the list was There Will Be Blood in 2007. And if I updated it today, I don't think any movie from 2008 or 2009 would actually make it onto the list. So I probably won't change it that much. But I get kind of annoyed when I look at lists, and they're like, you know, top 10 speeches of all time in film. And it's all movies made in the last 2 years or 3 years. You know, maybe they'll throw in some movie from the 80s or 90s just because they're trying to be varied. And it very well may be that the best ones that you've seen are in the last 2 or 3 years, but I don't think you should label a list best unless you've at least seen a lot of movies in that genre. You know, I have my greatest speeches, but I probably should label it my favorite speeches. Same with my top 100, should be top 100 favorite movies. But list making is always a very difficult thing because you kind of have to balance appeal and personality. Because when I make my list, I'm not gonna lie and say, well, I'm not gonna just sit there and go put down movies that I think other people want to see on my list. But if I dislike something and everyone likes something, maybe it deserves to be on the list, even if it's not a personal thing for me. I mean, there's an argument that can be made there. If everyone likes, I don't know, some song from a movie and I don't like it, maybe I put it in my top 10 best list though, because it's just widely accepted to be such something that everyone likes. I don't know. Just a thought, really. But there's something to be said for that, because all too often with lists, I see people either trying to be too obscure or too modern. And I think you have to find a balance between them while being yourself. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Because most of us just put lists together off the top of our heads. We don't really think about it. It's just a gut reaction. But usually when you do that, you forget about things that are important to you or that are important to the list. Because, I mean, I openly admit that when it comes to just, on the spot movie knowledge, I'm horrible. I can't think. You could ask me, what movie did you watch last night? I'm like, it was, the movie with the guy. The guy, the movie, the guy, the movie, the one with the guy and the thing that did the movie, That's just my personality. But you asked me a Kurosawa thing from a movie I saw 10 years ago. Got you covered. But there's something to be said for the way lists are kind of come into play, because it's a very personal thing, I think, list making. Which is why I don't really like the word best. But at the same time, it has to be something that appeals, because no matter how much we enjoy blogging, I don't think any of us write a blog just so that we can read it back to ourselves. We write it for ourselves, but with the intention of having other people read it. But nobody's going to read your blog if, well, some people might read your blog, if your top five films of all time are all independent French films made in the 1940s. You may feel better about yourself. And I've read some lists where I feel like people are pandering too much. Top five movies of all time. One, Godfather 2. Two. And, they're like, they're reading a list from, top five films. One, Citizen Kane. Two, Godfather Part Two. Three, that kind of thing, where they just feel like they're reading the AFI Top 100 films. And they're not really having an opinion of their own. So there's something to be said for people who put a lot of thought and effort into lists. There's also something to be said for people who do lists off the top of their gut and people who are honest with their lists. If your top five favorite films are all movies that were made last year, put it down. But don't just put it down because you're trying to appear as if, all that matters is the modern. Like, I feel as if blogs, like E Entertainment, when they do blogs posts, they're horrible about only including things that came out last couple years. It's a disastrous thing. And so, I don't like that. But I really do enjoy making lists. I'm thinking of starting to do it again. There's a lot of great list makers out there, so me being me, I'll probably try and do something really stupid and see if people enjoy it. Because that's how I blog. Everyone out there has all these different guides. My blogging technique is just keep writing stupid things and hopefully somebody will enjoy it. And maybe sneak in a moment of intelligence there with reviewing. You never know. That's why cookies are queens. Does that make any sense? No. But I think that's the perfect way to end a podcast. Bye.